thank you for that introduction, and thank you for coming along today. The other thing I'll add to the bio, which I think I'm the most terrified of, or I'm not sure if I'm going completely insane, after I do this presentation today, I'm going down to 259 George Street, the Suncorp building. I'm going to be abseiling off that building. So have lots of questions at the end, please. So listen very intently so I can defer my, I'm sure, insanity in the name of charity of abseiling off 259 George Street. And if you, on the way after, there'll be still quite a few of us doing it when you're finished. So on the way back to the office, I think it'll be worth it. Yeah, I know. I don't. It's one of these things the boys talk you into on Friday afternoon drink. But anyway.
Blame the boys.
So, on to more serious issues. Sustainable investment and the emergence of sustainability is a mainstream investment issue. What I'm going to take you through just over the next half an hour is really defining sustainability from an investment point of view, and you know, sort of doing that within the context of the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment, or the PRI. Welcome to Acronym World. What this means is also what we mean when we're talking about the mainstreaming of ESG, ESG standing for environmental, social and governance issues. I'll take you through what we've done at Colonial First State up until now and since we signed the PRI back in September last year, and take you through one of our best practice case studies to really demonstrate to you how we as mainstream fund managers are integrating a consideration of sustainability issues into our buy and sell decisions for listed companies. So first of all, defining sustainability from a mainstream investment point of view. When we at Colonial First State talk about sustainability from an investment point of view, we're talking about the environmental, social and governance issues that have the potential to impact the share price performance of the companies that we invest in. When we're talking about it within the context of the PRI, we're not talking about socially responsible or ethical investing. We're not talking about the style of investing where you'll determine a particular sector or stock that you want to screen out of your investments because of a moral or ethical view. So we're not talking about screening out uranium, alcohol, tobacco, or any of those sectors that may be associated with unsustainable activities. Rather, we're talking about integrating a consideration of ESG issues into all of our investment decisions across all asset classes and all companies. So it's not about screening out companies that we think that we might be doing a good or bad job or might be unmoral or unethical. I mean, who's morals, who's ethics? I think I personally prop up the share price of Foster's. But it's about embedding a consideration of these issues into your investment decisions, about understanding the sustainability issues that can impact the growth of the company and the risk of the company. And so this has really been embraced as a concept by investors globally. In Australia, we've got more signatories to these things called the United Nations Principles for Responsible Investment than any other country. And the context to these principles is that all the investors that have signed up have recognised that sustainability is an investment issue and needs to be considered as one, and that it's not just a socially responsible or ethical issue that they might offer to some investors off on the side. And so these principles really are about mainstreaming a consideration of ESG issues into their investment decision-making process. And I'll take you through each of them because I'm sure they're new to most of you. They haven't been around that long. The first principle is that we will integrate a consideration of sustainability issues into the investment decision. So let's take a Foster's for an example. Some socially responsible or ethical investors would screen out Foster's and not hold Foster's because they think it's unethical. Our approach to looking at investing in Foster's is recognising that there are issues around Foster's social licence to operate in terms of the sale of alcohol and the potential impacts of excessive alcohol consumption on society. There are environmental issues associated with an investment in Foster's in terms of their water use, their energy consumption, different carbon trading type schemes and the impacts that may have on the company's operating costs. And then like any other company, social issues also impact the ability of a company like Foster's to deliver on its business objectives. It's all about human capital. Have they got an engaged workforce? Have they got a good approach to managing their people? So we'll ask ourselves all of those questions in making the buy or sell decision in Foster's and what we're willing to pay for it. And if we think the company's doing a really good job on managing its social license to operate issues, water issues, and they can make a litre of beer with less water than any other brewer in the world. I think it's 3.5 litres of water for 1 litre of beer. Is there anybody from Foster's here? Is that right? I think there's a Lyme Nathan person, so sorry. You probably know. So it is. They are the most efficient. So we know they're using water efficiently. So these are the types of things, and it will impact what price we'll pay for Foster's in the market. So that's about incorporating it into the mainstream investment decision-making process. The second principle is that we'll be active owners in the companies that we invest in. So it's not just about buying shares in the company and sitting on our laurels and selling it when we think it's got to a certain price. It's rather about being active owners and engaging the companies that we invest in and encouraging them to adopt best practice environmental, social and governance practices. And this really kind of came out of Justice Neville Owen's inquiry into the HIH collapse. And one of the key things that Justice Neville Owen came out and said is that shareholders, if they're not active and if they don't tell the company what's expected of them from a governance point of view, how are they supposed to know how to act? And Justice Neville Owen's inquiry into HIH had a very strong theme of what the shareholders' responsibility is in terms of encouraging companies to have good governance practices. And then no matter how good the practices are, if you don't tell us about them in terms of disclosure, we don't know what's going on. And so the third principle is really that we will encourage the companies that we invest in to report on their management of ESG issues. We do that through encouraging companies to do integrated reporting into their financial statements, but then we also do things like sign up to the Carbon Disclosure Project and encourage all of the companies that we write to, so the ASX 200, but also 3,000 companies, as large as companies globally, to report to us how they're managing the carbon and climate change issues associated with their business. We can then use that detailed information, again, in our investment decision-making processes. The four through to six are really called the play nice clauses. It's about promoting the acceptance of the principles within the industry. So, I mean, doing things like this and explaining what they're all about and working across the industry to enhance the effectiveness. And for this is about really working with our supply chain. It's a different sort of case in terms of our biggest suppliers are really stockbrokers. So stockbrokers give us daily research, wads, piles of research on companies. So for us, it's about going to those brokers and saying, well, as a supplier of research to us, we also want you to integrate environmental, social and governance considerations in that research that you provide to us on a daily basis. So getting an effective supply chain, not only in terms of their behaviours and practices, but also what they deliver. And also that we'll report on our activities, which is the final principle. I'm very pleased to say that we were the first Australian fund manager to get a report out on how we're actually implementing the principles into our investment decision-making processes, and you can get that off our website. And as I said earlier, there's more Australian signatories to the UNPRI than any other country. So I think that's something that really is a testament to the fact that our superannuation fund industry is probably one of the most progressive in terms of their thinking around ESG issues and have really embraced this concept of the UNPRI. But why? What's the business case for all of this? And I think, we're hard-nosed fund managers and we're Australia's largest fund manager and we really are in this to make money. We're not moral crusaders. We really are doing this to make the best investment decisions. So I'll take the opportunity to go back to the business case. In funds management, we like charts and we like things that we can put into Excel. So a chart appropriately put up here. And this is some work that was done by PwC and Schroders in Europe. And have any of you had the pleasure of dealing with investment analysts very much? So, there are certain types. I mean, I work with them every day. I've been one of them. So there are certain types. So you can imagine this scenario. They've got a whole lot of investment analysts and they split them up into two groups. One lot of investment analysts they put into one room and they gave them only traditional financial information, so what you might call the back of the annual report. The other set of analysts they put into another room and they gave them two sets of information, the traditional financial information but also what they call extra financial information, which included a lot around sustainability or ESG type factors. So the analysts that only had the financial information had a much wider spread of earnings forecasts and were much less accurate in their earnings forecasts of the company, as opposed to the analysts that had both sets of information. And I think this is a really important slide to highlight in terms of the business case of considering ESG issues, is that you don't consider these issues in isolation of the financials. It's really about undertaking an extra analysis of extra financial issues to make a better investment decision. So we don't, for a second, think that you can rate a company on its ESG performance alone and invest on that signal alone and outperform. I don't think that that's a valid case. And that's what a lot of some of the socially responsible and ethical funds do. They'll say, that company's fantastic on environment. We want to own some of that company. But if that company's trading at a massive takeover premium, you're not going to make any money out of it. There's no share price upside. It's already in the price. So that's where you have to consider sustainability within the context of the financials of the company. But when you do, you'll make better investment decisions. And then we can't talk about the business case on ESG without talking about carbon and climate change issues. I mean, I think this is probably the nirvana of the ESG advocates' approach to sustainability, because really now we have a scenario where we're pricing externalities and we can get a whole lot of data that we can put into spreadsheets and really look at the materiality of the impact of carbon trading on the companies. Now, I don't for a second want to suggest that just by looking at climate change issues, you're looking at all of the ESG issues. There's a very broad set of ESG issues that you need to consider, but I'm just talking about the carbon ones here today because it's probably what everybody's talking about and you'd be interested in how we're dealing with it. So not a day does go by where there isn't some kind of mention of carbon and climate change type issues. Even our stockbrokers are coming through to us on a daily basis with the impact that carbon trading is going to have on the companies that we invest in. So there is plenty of information for us out there to start to price the impact the emissions trading scheme is going to have, even if the emissions trading scheme hasn't actually started. And so that's what we did when we were working through the investor group on climate change, which is a collaborative initiative that we're a part of. And we look to work across the investment sector and share investment and share learning. So we did some research 18 months or so ago and looked at three scenarios under the emissions trading scheme. The first is where 100% of a company's emissions were covered by the scheme. So a company would need to buy permits for 100% of their emissions. And they would have to buy all of those permits through auctions. So there'd be nothing allocated to them for free. So really this would be worst case scenario. The second, this is for steel sector companies. The second was where we excluded process emissions. So when you're making steel, there's a lot of greenhouse emissions from the electricity that you use, but then the actual chemical process of making steel emits CO2, well, greenhouse gases into the atmosphere as well. So under this scenario, those emissions wouldn't be covered, but you would still have 100% auctioning of permits and 100% pass-through in terms of electricity costs. And then a more, what we think is reasonable scenario, and interestingly what's actually been proposed under the CPRS, and that's where carbon pollution reduction scheme, 100% of the emissions are covered, but 90% of them are given to the steel sector companies for free because they've got what's competitiveness at risk or their emissions intensive trade exposed. And as you can see, there's a massive variance in the potential impact that will have on companies in the steel sector. Worst case scenario is $25 average carbon price, you're looking at an average $500 million impact for your typical steel company. And we're looking, that's for 41% EBITDA impact for the year that we did the analysis. So we're talking material impact to the profitability and earnings of a typical steel company. So we're able to look at that scenario. But then if you have a look under scenario 3, at a $25 carbon price, but 90% of the permits for free, it really is quite a manageable impact on the steel sector companies. So us as investors look at this information, we get this information, we look at the companies in the steel sector, and under the proposed scheme, so scenario 3, we just need to adjust the share price forecasts that we have for companies in that sector and the prices at which we will buy those companies and sell those companies. So it's not that we say companies in the steel sector, oh, they're really emissions intensive, we're going to have a carbon trading scheme, we better sell them, we can't own them. It's rather we do integrated financial analysis and investment decision making to understand, firstly, the impact the emissions trading scheme will have on those companies, and then what that does to the potential earnings of the companies and what price we're willing to pay. So that's about the risk and how we look to assess the risk that comes out of ESG issues. And it's similar for social issues. You know, we'll do similar types of analysis in terms of very people-intensive businesses, and we'll look at the average cost of employing people, to sort of what the potential increases in wage costs are going to do to the profitability of those companies, what potential savings there can be if companies reduce their turnover by only 5%, what's the materiality of that to the company, and so what are we willing to pay for that company in terms of its share price. So there's risks, but there's also opportunities. So we invest across all types of markets, listed and unlisted markets. So we've got a lot of infrastructure investments. We own toll roads, power stations, all sorts of things. Can anybody tell me why this wouldn't be a power station of the future? There must be an agricultural person here somewhere. Yep. The wrong end of the cow. And that certainly presents some interesting images of power stations of the future across regional Australia. So there are, more seriously though, a lot of investment opportunities that are extremely bizarre. But one that came to us the other day was a small company that effectively feeds your colt to pigs. That's the, you know, I'm not an agricultural person, so I can't remember the chemical process, but you've all seen your colt. You know, it's supposed to help your digestive system. And they have this one for pigs. And that does decrease the methane intensity of the fart of the pig. So if they feed this stuff to pigs in China and they're able to demonstrate a reduction in business as usual methane intensity of the pig, these guys are generating CERs, so certified emission reductions, which are tradable carbon credits. They sell them then to liable parties in Europe. So there are these weird and bizarre and wonderful investment opportunities that are out there that are presented by this emergence of this carbon market and pricing of externalities. And that one is a little bit too high risk and a little bit sort of unknown for us, so we didn't invest in the your cult for pigs project. But we are looking more seriously at a whole lot of other renewable energy type projects, and then even through our property portfolios, looking at what opportunities there are there with an increasing electricity price associated with a carbon trading scheme. What type of buildings do the buildings of the future look like for us? What can we do to our property portfolios to future-proof them and make them more attractive investment opportunities for our investors? So quickly I'll just go through what we've been doing since we signed up to the principles, just to give you a bit of sense of how our business as a whole has responded and why we've done it. So as I said, we signed up in March 2007, and it was a commitment across all of our asset classes. So it's across the listed shares that we invest in, the infrastructure, the property, fixed income, all of the asset classes, emerging markets, that we were going to integrate a consideration of these things. We did it because we firmly do believe that these issues are material investment issues and it will allow us to make better investment decisions across the business. When you talk to your traditional sort of fund manager, especially managers like us who are very sort of fundamental bottom-up, we're not really quant managers who will invest just off the spreadsheets. We always like to know the companies. We go and visit the mine sites. We are bottom-up. A lot of the stuff we were doing implicitly anyway, and signing up to the PRI really gave us an opportunity to make it more explicit how we were considering these issues. It also better aligns us with the long-term interests of our clients. Our clients are primarily superannuation funds, or at the end of the day, yourself. Most of you are too young to be thinking, you know, trading your superannuation like you're retiring tomorrow. You've got a good 20, 30 years, unfortunately, till retirement. So, you know, we need to align ourselves with the long-term interests of our superannuation funds, and the PRI helps us do that. There's also all the human capital benefits, and I'm sure it's come up today, sustainability stuff and all these Gen Yers, and our grads love this, and that's not part of the reason that we've signed up, but it really has helped us attract some of the best graduates when we're competing with the big global investment banks, so that's been fantastic. And then really it's been about the governance processes that we put in place internally to implement the principles across the business. So this really is a fundamentally sort of cultural change program that we need to implement for fund managers who are inherently very often short-term in focus. They drive their spreadsheets like they drive their Ferraris. This is about getting them to sit back, stop, take a bigger picture view of the companies that they're investing in and take a more sort of considered approach. We have all the policies in place. We have the internal reporting metrics in place. We're now reporting publicly. We've got extensive education programs for all of our investment analysts and executives, and it's really about engaging and embarking on that cultural change program. And we participate in lots of collaborative initiatives and cross-investment sector initiatives, like the Investor Group on Climate Change, where we did and contributed to that steel sector work, like the Carbon Disclosure Project, where with a number of other investors we write to companies and ask them how they're managing these issues, ASRIA, which is a sustainable investment network through the Asia Pacific, International Corporate Governance Network, and the Green Building Council. And then just to show you how it's actually come through into a portfolio. So you can go back to your investor relations people and say, this is really important, we need to be doing this because some chick from Colonial said that it's going to impact our share price. So our listed infrastructure team, their investment process is 50% quantitative, so the numbers, Excel stuff, and 50% qualitative. Within that qualitative framework, they look at the structure of the industry, the quality of the management, the financial reporting of the company, the regulatory frameworks that the company is exposed to, sustainability metrics, and then equity flows, so really the liquidity of the company. And sustainability accounts for 15% of that qualitative score. And within each company, every company receives a 1 through to 5 for ESG issues. The guys look at a whole lot of external data factors. We use Innovest, so we subscribe to that and get 3,000 companies globally covered through subscribing to that database. But we also use a whole lot of other external research, anything we can get our hands on to give us insight into what a company is saying. And we use another one. I haven't updated this slide. I love it. We call it the Kodak Count. And we go through a company's sustainability report, and this is a note to any of you who publish them, and the more pictures there are of kids running through the grass, holding hands, the more problems we think there are with the company. So the higher the Kodak count, the lower the score for the company. Seriously, and it does give you a lot of insight, especially emerging market companies. But then we go through ISS stuff, Governance Matrix International, there's this great thing called Audit Integrity's Most Trustworthy Companies. Anything we can get our hands on to test what the company's telling us, we'll reference. But then it is put into a spreadsheet. We've got to put it into a spreadsheet. And so this is just the companies that we hold in the listed infrastructure portfolio. Some of them I don't even know because it's a global portfolio. So it goes through, and the second line from the top is the sustainability scores that have been aggregated up for the company within the context of all of the other qualitative scores. And what this shows you, this got a pointer thing on it. Anyway, the company down at the end, because it has quite relatively poor sustainability and governance type factors, it has to be much cheaper, so at a much bigger discount to the share price at which it's trading, for us to invest in it. Because that's the only way that we can feel comfortable that we're not exposing ourselves unnecessarily to sustainability type risks. So this is the type of chart that you show to your investor relations type people, because they're all, and your CEOs, they're all incentivised by the share price of the company. So if they can demonstrate that they're a better managed company through their rigorous approach to sustainability, we're going to own more of the shares of that company. And so that's the key chart for you, and that it's integrated into the investment decision-making processes. And it has helped. Now I've stuffed it up. It has helped in terms of the performance of this portfolio. This is the best listed infrastructure portfolio in the world. So it's the type of fund, it hasn't even been going a year, so anyway, the guys are quite new, but that's okay. It's the type of fund that I'd want my super in. And it's not because of sustainability, but it's because sustainability is one aspect of their overall financial analysis. So in conclusion, I hope I've convinced you today that sustainability issues are now recognised as mainstream investment issues across both superannuation and funds management, that the business case has been accepted for sustainability issues. Not necessarily, and I'm careful, not necessarily for corporate social responsibility or doing things just because it feels right, but stuff that can be demonstrated to add to shareholder value has been accepted as a reasonable investment parameter. And the companies that are doing more work on sustainability and being proactive in communicating this to the market and to the investment analysts, should be recognised in terms of their performance. So on that, thank you very much.